again.
I have a call, 96-3615CR, State v. Darren D. Burns. Mr. Cushing, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, appellant petitioner Burns. Mr. Cushing?
Yes, may it please the court, my name is Glenn Cushing. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender. I appear here today on behalf of Darren Burns, who was the defendant in the trial court, the appellant in the Court of Appeals, and is the petitioner in this court. The issue presented by this case is whether a criminal defendant who appears in court ostensibly for the purpose of pleading either guilty or no contest to a criminal charge can be convicted and sentenced when no plea is ever actually entered by the defendant. The facts can be fairly briefly summarized. Mr. Burns was charged with homicide by operation of a motor vehicle while intoxicated. That crime carries a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. In January of 96, he appeared in circuit court for Waupaca County, apparently and ostensibly prepared to change his plea from not guilty to no contest. He completed and filed a plea questionnaire and written waiver of rights form that had a box checked near the top that said, I wish to enter a plea of no contest. That form went on, listed all of the constitutional rights that he would be waiving by his plea. It advised him as to the maximum sentence he was facing and the legal elements of the crime of homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle.
Counsel, why isn't the phrase, I wish to, sufficient to equate to I am? Why isn't it that fair to interpret I wish to as?
Well, I guess my answer to that would be the word wish connotes something in the future, just as I intend to, or I wish to, or I desire to. To me, we all wish for a lot of things that we don't get and that we don't do. So that wishing for something, to me, is not doing it. That's one answer. The second answer, of course, here is that that word appeared only on the plea questionnaire. It's my position that wishing to or desiring or intending to is not adequate to constitute a plea. But if this court were to decide differently and to decide that those types of phrases would be adequate, it would still be my position that Mr. Burns is entitled to relief, because the only place that appears in this record is in that written plea questionnaire. The trial court did not take even the rudimentary step of reaffirming with Mr. Burns that that was true when he was there personally in front of him.
Let me take that phrase. And here's the question from the court. And Mr. Smith, how do you wish to plead? And Mr. Smith says, Judge, I wish to plead no contest. What is that? Is that a plea?
It's my position that it's not a plea, but
how about
I don't.
Mr. Smith, how do you plead? I want to plead no contest. Is that a plea?
Probably, but again, we can go through a variety of different ways in which this can be said. My position is that the court should make a clear and simple rule so that this problem doesn't continue to arise. And this really is a very simple thing to do. It isn't complicated.
You're asking for a magical word. In other words, the key words have to be what? What are you saying?
I can't ask for any magic words. I know that, and I don't want to. What I want is for the court to adopt a rule that requires a direct and specific admission, an oral admission from the defendant to his guilt or to the plea, that does not use terms of intending to do something in the future, because one can change a mind even in the course of a plea proceeding. And of course, various judges do this in different ways, and I have seen judges who will start out with that question. Mr. Burns, do you intend to plead guilty today? Answer, yes. Okay, before you do, I have some questions I have to ask you. And then the judge will go through the colloquy, all the rights, make sure the defendant knows what he's doing and wants to do with it. And then at the end of that, go back and say, Mr. Burns, now knowing all of these facts, do you plead guilty? Or what is your plea? And so I understand that there are various ways that this can be done. I'm not saying that the defendant has to say the words guilty or no contest. It could be done by the judge saying, how do you plead? The defendant would plead guilty or no contest. The judge could go, Mr. Burns, do you plead no contest or guilty? Mr. Burns could answer in the affirmatively, yes. That would be sufficient. I believe it would be sufficient, although it is my position that the attorney cannot enter the plea on behalf of the defendant. I believe that if the attorney does so in the defendant's presence, and the court then turns to the defendant, for instance, what is your client's plea? Mr. Attorney, my client pleads no contest. There, the judge needs to turn to the defendant, and he could say simply, is this true? The defendant affirms yes. Is this correct? The defendant affirms yes. So I'm really not trying to say that there's one magic way to do it. There's more than one way to do it, but it never happened at this proceeding. Whatever this court decides constitutes an appropriate plea. And if this court should determine that, as Justice Bradley asked, if do you want to plead guilty, and he says yes, or do you wish to plead guilty, and he says yes, or do you intend to plead guilty, and he says yes, if this court adopts that as a sufficient basis for a plea, it's still my position as Mr. Burns' attorney that that didn't happen at this proceeding. There was no question at any time to Mr. Burns as to whether his lawyer's statement that he intended to change his plea was correct, whether he wished to plead, whether he intended or wanted to. None of those words were really used at any point.
Well, if I might interrupt for a minute. I'm looking at page 110 of the transcript, and this is part of the colloquy that the court had with your client. The court, do you have any questions that you wish to ask the court in regard to the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form? Your client answered, no, sir. Have you had enough time to thoroughly discuss this case and the effects of your plea to this offense with Attorney Johnson? Mr. Burns, yes. The court, do you have any questions that you wish to ask the court in regard to your rights on this matter? Mr. Burns, no. Then the court goes into a discussion with the attorney. Why isn't that enough? You got a plea questionnaire, waiver of rights form that says, I wish to enter a plea of no contest. You've got the attorney saying, my client wants to enter a plea of no contest. And then you've got this colloquy. Why isn't that sufficient? Is there really any question that he wishes to enter a plea and is entering a plea of no contest?
Well, it's my position that there still is a question as to what he would have said if he was asked, do you plead guilty or what is your plea? I believe that the better rule is that it should require a direct and specific admission and not be left to the drawing of inferences from the record. It would be my opinion that there may be an inference here that he intended to do this, I don't believe that's a sufficient inference to allow this court to say that he did plead guilty.
Well, is there anything that runs counter to that inference? Anything at all?
Only the fact that he was never asked to plead and he never did plead and he never said that his lawyer's statement was correct.
Court says to him on page 110, have you had enough time to thoroughly discuss this case and the effects of your plea to this offense with Attorney Johnson? I'm reading 8 through 10, and your client answers yes. So the assumption in that question is that there is a plea.
Well, the assumption was that he's had enough time to discuss the effects of his plea. I mean, that's explicit. But I have seen transcripts where clients choke on the words when asked the direct question. It does happen. I won't say it happens a lot or all the time, but there are clients who go through this kind of a colloquy who seem prepared to do it, and then when it comes right down to the crunch, can't do it.
Or can't say guilty, or can't say
right,
guilty.
Or all of a sudden something else comes, well, I didn't mean to do it, or, you know, I changed my mind. I mean, the point, I think, is that this is a guilty plea. This ends the proceedings against a criminal defendant. This is a very important proceeding in the criminal justice system. It has been described by the U.S. Supreme Court in various different terms. as a serious and sobering occasion, as a grave and solemn act. And if there's any place, and I know normally the phrase is, you know, we want reality over ritual, we don't want to require any magic words, all of these are appropriate concepts, but if there's any area of the law where a certain amount of formality should be imposed on the proceeding, I think that this is the proceeding where we need to do it. And it will also, as a matter of policy, it helps prevent this kind of serial litigation of these problems over and over and over again from clients who claim afterwards that, you know, I didn't know this or I didn't intend to do this. And then we are left with records. I mean, this court's decision in Banger is 13 years old now. And to me, it seems to have made very little impact on the procedures used in the actual taking of pleas, because we constantly are trying to deal with these problems of plea proceedings where things were left out and not done correctly, and then you get involved in this huge burden-shifting prima facie case procedure that Banger created, and this is just another aspect of that problem, and it would seem to me better to cure this, because it's very simple to do, and it may be time for the court and its supervisory authority to just make a rule which would be enforced. And I think that very shortly thereafter, these problems would stop happening.
Now, I'm still not sure when you look at 97108 and you're talking about, just tell me what you feel that your client did not knowingly, intelligently, or voluntarily not know about this action. What was missing here? What I hear from you is that we should have him affirmatively state what he was pleading to. In other words, I'm pleading guilty, no contest, whatever. Or something similar to that.
That's correct. And there's no claim. I have never made a claim that whatever happened at this proceeding was not knowing and voluntary. That is, there's no particular problem with this colloquy and what this judge did in complying with Banger. Everything is here that needs to be here, except the actual entry of the plea, which was the purpose of the proceeding, for the defendant to admit his guilt and close the proceedings, not for the lawyer to say, "Judge, we're here today because my client has decided to change his plea." That doesn't constitute an admission that I feel should be sufficient. I guess I would point to
the thing is that then, if you made that first hurdle, then we take a look at the totality, and you seem to say, "Yes, I agree. Under the totality, there's no question what my client did." In other words, you look at that, and then that's the burden, of course, of the state. But that is what I think I'd like an answer to. In other words, looking at this entire situation of how the plea was taken, the written information, the record that was just read to you by the Chief Justice and Justice Crooks, as I understand, it's just that you want something more, quote, definite and certain, so that it just nails it down.
That's one way of putting it. Mine would be he never pled guilty. If the court wants to infer from this record, where he was never asked what his plea was, he was never asked if he pled guilty, that he did, because he answered a lot of questions that indicated he knew what rights he would waive by his plea, you know, that is ultimately the court's decision to make. The problem with that type of decision is that it leaves everyone hanging in the future. Then the next time we get a record and maybe one question is different, or the judge left out a couple of questions that were asked here, then do we come back again and say, well, was this one okay? And the problem is trying to infer from a record which contains no direct plea, whether he did or didn't plea, leaves this to be a continually litigated issue depending on the particular colloquy in each case. And that's the problem that I and my office faces when we constantly get these guilty plea transcripts where things are missing. Now, I want it clear so there's no confusion that I never have alleged or claimed that this colloquy, other than the failure to obtain the plea, was defective in some form. That is, if Mr. Burns had pled guilty, had been, you know, how do you plead, Mr. Burns? I plead no contest. The rest of this is sufficient. I don't believe there would have been a grounds to challenge the plea. But, you know, I want to point out to this court that it's not unheard of for this court to have required something right out of the defendant's mouth and brooking no inferences or anything from the attorney. And I would take the standard, this court imposed such a rule in State versus Farr, which is discussed at pages 9 and 10 of my brief. The context of Farr was proving that a defender is a repeat offender, so that he is subject to enhanced sentencing penalties when it comes to sentencing. And in order for a defendant to be sentenced as a repeat offender, there has to be adequate proof in the record that he actually qualifies for that sentencing procedure. The state can either prove it by submitting documentary evidence that establishes it, or the proof can be simply by obtaining an admission from the defendant that he has those prior convictions or that he admits that he is a repeater. And in Farr, the state argued that that admission could be inferred from the record which occurred there, when there was all kinds of discussion about the maximum penalty that was applicable and that he was a repeater. His attorney raised no objection. Nobody said anything. And the state argued that they had waived their right to object, and that the court should infer that he was a repeater from that record. And the court rejected that analysis and very specifically required the language from the court was a direct and specific admission from the defendant, and that his lawyer's admission was not sufficient, and that the court would not infer the admission from the record. And I believe that if this court can apply that rule to whether someone can be sentenced as a repeater, it can apply a similar rule to whether someone has admitted his guilt in open court so as to justify continuing on with the proceedings and the sentencing.
Mr. Cushing, what exactly is the relief that you are seeking?
Vacation of the judgment of conviction and the sentence which was imposed on Mr. Burns, with a remand to the trial court for further proceedings from the point that they got to at this proceeding.
So to go through it once again? Is that?
Well, Mr. Burns would then be entitled to decide whether he wanted to reach some type of additional plea bargain or whether he wanted to have a jury trial.
What would be the status of count one?
Well, what happens in these cases, this is a homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle. It's automatically, normally, if there's a breath test or a blood alcohol content test taken and the number is over the limit, a .10, it's almost automatically charged as two counts. One, operating while under the influence, which is independent of the blood alcohol test. The second count is driving with the test over the limit. The defendant cannot be convicted and sentenced to both counts. If there is a trial at which both counts are tried, one is vacated at the conclusion. There's a statute that governs this. There's a statutory provision that provides that if there's a conviction of both, the defendant may be sentenced on only one. So normally, at a plea proceeding, you would just plead to one of them, and they would dismiss the other one, because you can't be convicted of both. If there's a trial, it gets taken care of after the verdict. So it's kind of interesting, because the plea questionnaire seems to indicate that this plea was entered pursuant to a plea bargain. It, in fact, has that box checked. It's another reason I believe that this court should reject what the state's position in their brief, that somehow this written plea questionnaire is the written equivalent of a guilty plea. It's not, and this court should not take that step. I mean, these documents are prepared sometimes in a very hasty fashion, sometimes well before the plea proceeding, during which time the defendant may have changed his mind. Sometimes they're prepared mere minutes before the plea proceeding while counsel's sitting at the table waiting to do it. This form says that there was a plea bargain. Well, there was no plea bargain that I can discern from the record.
Would it be fair to say that this was probably either just an oversight by the court, or perhaps a misunderstanding by the court that the statement by Mr. Johnson was in effect, or was in fact, the entry of a plea of no contest.
That's probably a fair statement. I haven't accused the court of any kind of intentional attempt to get a plea entered secretly. I'm sure it was just an oversight.
If that's a fair statement, after the proceeding in which that colloquy occurred, didn't the defendant participate in both the pre-sentence examination and then a formal sentencing hearing?
Yes, he did.
Actually, the motion here is not filed almost 6 months later. Why shouldn't we say, look, whatever deficiency there was here, probably wasn't intentional. You knew it was going on, and you waited for 6 months before you complained about it.
Well, first of all, the motion was filed by me, and it's my job to review this record and determine whether errors were made that warrant relief. And Mr. Burns is not an attorney, of course, and he had no knowledge of the defect which I believe existed in this record. That's my job, to find the defects if they exist, inform him of his choices about this and what I think might be accomplished, so that I don't believe that he had any knowledge that there may have been a defect in this proceeding that would warrant relief. I think that this court certainly could find that failing to actually enter a plea warrants relief even after the conviction. This court becomes convinced that what should have occurred didn't, even if it was just an oversight. I mean, numerous errors that occur which result in the reversal of criminal convictions occur simply as oversights. It isn't necessarily intentional when a trial judge misstates a jury instruction or fails to do something that should have been done that this court determines requires a new trial. So, I mean, just the fact that it was an oversight in and of itself, I don't think should deprive Mr. Burns of the right to complain now. It was my job to find the error, and my argument now is simply that this court should adopt a rule and enforce it on the trial courts so that this kind of litigation doesn't continue to occur.
Mr. Cushing.
That's the biggest problem that I see here.
Mr. Cushing.
I'm sorry.
I want to make a statement to you so that you can respond to it. It sounds to me, reading your briefs and listening to your argument, that you are advocating a magic word test. Certain magic words have to be in the record or it's no good.
Trying not to.
Right, but that sure sounds like it. And as I look back over the 13, 14 years since this really came into the forefront with Cecchini seemed to establish a magic word test, but we quickly overruled, at least in part, Cecchini with Bangert. And I think what we did conceptually with Bangert was we said, you don't have to have a magic word test. You look at the whole record. There were different issues involved, obviously, as you well know, but it seems to me that that has been now the standard in this state for, well, ever since Bangert was decided in when was it, 1986? Why should we go back? I mean, I guess you've given us our argument, but I'm not convinced that Cecchini is going to be any more powerful or persuasive on the trial courts of this state and on this court than it was back in 1986 when we just almost did a flip on Cecchini.
Well, my personal belief is that you should have stuck with Cecchini.
Yeah, I wrote it. I thought it was a terrific opinion.
I'm not dependent on your reinstating Cecchini in order for me to succeed. I don't believe. And I haven't argued here that you should overrule Bangert and go back to Cecchini. It certainly is within your power and your authority to do that. But Bangert was addressed in Cecchini at a slightly different issue, in my opinion, than what's presented here. Those cases dealt with certain knowledge that the defendant needed to have in order for the plea to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Did he know what the maximum was? Did he know what he was doing? Did he know what rights he was waiving? Did he understand the consequences?
But see, here I look at this very parallel. Did he know that he was going to plead, that he was pleading guilty? I read this and it just fairly leaps out of the pages at me. Your client knew what he was there for. He knew that he was going to enter a plea of guilty, and it was only through an oversight of the trial judge that he didn't say the magic words. But I mean, you don't even claim that he was there and somehow mistakenly didn't intend to enter a plea of guilty. That was his whole purpose for being there.
No, but I don't claim to know what he would have said if he was asked. And I think that it still remains speculation for this court to assume that he would have pled guilty or no contest if he'd been directly asked. That's the problem. He never did it. And he might have intended to, this court might infer that he intended to, but my position is he didn't. And that's enough to vacate the conviction. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Cushing. I'm sorry, are there any other questions? No. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Excuse me. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing respondent state of Wisconsin. Defendant Darren Burns is seeking vacation of his conviction for homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle on grounds that he never personally pled no contest to the charge. In a nutshell, he wants to start over because during the plea colloquy, the trial court did not verbally or orally ask him, how do you plead, so as to elicit the response from him orally, I plead no contest. The state asked this court to conclude as follows. At the time of a plea colloquy, a trial court must ensure on the record of the plea hearing that the defendant has personally made the decision to plead guilty or no contest. That's what due process requires. A court's oral inquiry of the defendant, how do you plead, helps to ensure this. But neither due process nor the statutes require the defendant or the court to obtain an oral statement from the defendant before the court may accept the defendant's plea of guilty or no contest.
Does due process require that a plea be made in a criminal case?
Well, the statutes certainly do, and I would guess that due process also would, certainly from the defendant, since...
And as you emphasize, personally made the decision, this is, an extension of what Justice Babbage was asking. Cheney and Bankard deal with the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, and stand in part for the proposition that you can infer from a variety of sources, including the record, that a plea was knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made. The decision...
Sure.
As you say in your brief. But it seems to me conceptually there is a difference between deciding to enter a plea and the entry of a plea. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. That's the distinction I'm trying to draw, is there's a difference between the decision being personally made and being conveyed. And in this case, not only is the record sufficient to show that it was a personal decision, but that it was personally conveyed to the court by the defendant in the form of this written plea questionnaire.
When was this written plea questionnaire executed?
According to the record, it was done on the morning of the plea hearing.
What's the time differential? I don't know if the plea hearing, I know it was on the 16th of January.
Right, the same day, but I don't have anything in terms of like minutes or hours, if that's what you're asking.
That's what I want to know.
Yes, nothing in the record.
Does your argument make any difference, let's say, if they met with the client at 8 a.m. and the plea was held at 2:30 in the afternoon?
I would say it makes no difference.
Is your argument any different if they met with the client and the plea questionnaire was executed 1 week prior to the actual plea hearing?
It would make no difference. And the reason why I say that is that when the defendant, the language "I wish" suggests a future event, but it becomes a present sense expression when it's presented to the court, and the court thereafter undertakes that personal colloquy with the defendant that's required under 97108 and Bangert.
Let's assume in this case then that "I wish" was made a week before the plea hearing. We'll just change that fact. What in the record illustrates that the "I wish" statement made a week before the plea hearing is indeed the entry of a plea a week later?
Again, of course, that is not the facts in this case, but if it were the facts...
Because we don't know the time difference, you're saying. We don't know if it's
absolutely
6 hours, 2 minutes, 8
sure.
hours. Okay, so what can you point to in the record
taking that fact difference, that the I wish was made a week beforehand, what can you point to in the record that transforms an I wish made a week prior to the time of the hearing to an entry of a plea at the hearing?
Two things. One is it's presented to the court, that plea questionnaire. The court asks the defendant personally, have you personally prepared this questionnaire? It's signed by him.
Okay, if you would, take a look, please, at the plea hearing and point to me then what you are referring to. What makes a I wish a week earlier translate into the entry of a plea?
Sure. I believe it was page 7, if I remember correctly, where it begins. Or actually, in the defendant's appendix, it's pages 106, 107. On 106, the attorney first says, my client is changing his plea to no contest. Then at the top of page 7, which is 107 in the appendix, the court asks, do you have a plea questionnaire? Counsel says, yes, Your Honor. The court says, Mr. Burns, you completed the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form today. Yes, sir.
Okay, assume in my fact
right,
situation,
that it's a week
last
earlier.
Week.
Okay. I understand. Okay. And did you understand that form? Yes, sir. Have you had enough time to discuss this matter with Attorney Johnson? Yes, Your Honor. Then I believe on page 108, the court goes on to, when the court now is addressing the defendant personally, about line 8, do you understand the various rights, including constitutional rights, that are set forth in the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form? Yes, sir. Do you understand that you're giving up those rights by entry of your plea? Yes, sir. Also, in the plea questionnaire itself, after the defendant at the top says, I wish to plead no contest, later in that questionnaire, he goes on, this is a signed document by him, he goes on to say, quote, I understand that I'm giving up the following rights by this plea, unquote. Another quote, I understand that I can be found guilty by the judge if my plea is accepted, unquote. Another quote, I am making the decision to enter this plea of my own free will, unquote. During the plea colloquy itself, the defendant also orally acknowledged to the court that he understood the various constitutional rights that he was giving up, quote, by entry of your plea. During the colloquy itself, the defendant personally acknowledged his understanding of the elements of the charge to which he was pleading and the direct consequences of the plea.
So again, you're referring to the two pages.
That's also on page 8, and it may go on to page 9, I think. For that.
You previously referred to page 107, lines 1 through 10, and 108, lines 8 through 14.
And also on page 10, if I may add, I think, which is 120, I believe, of the document. At lines 16 through 18, the defendant answered yes when the court asked him if he had enough time to, quote, discuss this case and the effects of your plea to this offense with counsel.
So those are the three excerpts from the transcript that would transform a form signed a week earlier into today's entry of a plea.
Is in conjunction correct? With the form itself and the language on that form, correct?
Thank you.
Does it make any difference now? The court goes on and just wanted to be involved in this discussion that the court then says to his counsel, and I'm not going to read this, but that you understand that his plea is being entered knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. Do you think he understands the nature of his plea and the effects of his plea and the elements of the crime? When we talk about the totality, the court then, after he questions the attorney, he's questioned the defendant as just read, the court then accepts the plea, and I accept the plea, and he goes through again that it's being made knowingly, intelligently, involuntarily. And certainly a defendant there could say, no, I never intended, that's a misintention. But he goes on to say, and I'm just indicating that the court then accepts in open court in front of the defendant on a timely basis that he finds him guilty in this case of homicide by operating a motor vehicle with a blood alcohol of over 1.0. Does that in the totality have any effect? Would the court then just say, I accept your plea, but not go through these words that he just used? Because this is a repetition of the words he used not only with Mr. Burns, but he used those with Attorney Johnson, and now he is repeating that again. So that really is the third time.
Absolutely. I guess that the way I would ask this court to view what the defendant is asking here is really just another species of plea withdrawal request. And the Banger test is an appropriate way to address this type of species of plea withdrawal request. The net result is the same. What the defendant wants is to go back and start over at the point where his not guilty plea was entered. It's very easy to see how Banger would work in this situation. A defendant would first have to show that the trial court failed to ensure on the record of the plea hearing that the defendant personally made the decision to plead guilty or no contest. If the defendant makes such a prima facie showing, the burden then shifts to the state to show on the record as a whole, including any post-conviction development, that the defendant personally made the decision to plead guilty or no contest. I would also suggest in this case that once the defendant presented the plea questionnaire with the "I wish to plead no contest" and all the other language on that questionnaire, it would have been redundant for the trial court to ask, "How do you plead?" The defendant has already presented the trial court with his plea.
Are you suggesting in the state of Wisconsin that we should say that trial judges don't have to ask?
Absolutely not. I'm just saying this is an alternative way, and what happened in this case is why perhaps this language, this question, "How do you plead?" didn't come out, because it would have been redundant under the circumstances. This court, if it so desired, if it's concerned that plea takings are not being accomplished with sufficiently, it could add to its mandatory requirements under Bangert a requirement that the trial court on the record orally say, "How do you plead?" But if it fails to do that, that shouldn't give the defendant a windfall of suddenly starting over again, just like in the situation of a knowing and voluntary plea. The requirement saying, "How do you plead?" is not a constitutional requirement. The voluntary knowingness of a plea is a constitutional requirement, and in that situation, we do allow consideration of the entire record. No less should be required in this situation.
Well, now, if you were drafting the opinion, counsel, would you take the position that the court should say is good practice in criminal cases that the court asked the defendant personally, "How does the defendant now plead?"
Yes. And I think the special materials actually already do provide for that.
And what about the bench book, or didn't you check?
I did not check the bench book.
But the special materials and the
SM-32.
SM-32. Do provide that. Okay. So you agree that that is better practice?
Yes.
And, but failing to keep up with that practice should not automatically allow withdrawal of plea. That's your
position. Exactly.
So, in what way does the requirement get enforced?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
In what way, then, does this better practice get enforced? I mean, we've been through this before. This is not the first case where the better practice is the trial court. You know, there's a lot of stuff in this, and you miss one of the bases here.
Sure.
And the court did a wonderful job on the colloquy, I thought, and missed one of the bases. So how do you enforce it? You just say, you know, the rule of harmless error means no enforcement.
Well, it's the same as any other situation with the voluntariness. I think a court's opinion, again, highlighting this, in Bangert, they don't really call attention, I don't believe, to the "how do you plead" aspect. This would sort of take Bangert to that next, to include that. It's in the special materials, I suppose, at the judicial conferences where the judges appear, that it could be. I mean, short of standing over the judge and saying, "Do this," also the prosecutor, of course, could step in here, as suggested in Bangert, and help out with this. Once this is made clear that this is a requirement, specific requirement, the prosecutor could help out the trial judge as well to ensure that the plea is taken appropriately.
One of the things that the bench book does indicate with regard to withdrawal of plea on grounds of manifest injustice, and for what it's worth, it says this: if the plea was not entered or ratified by the defendant or person authorized
to act in defendant's behalf. And I was kind of surprised to see that that was a grounds for withdrawal on grounds of manifest injustice. Manifest injustice may be shown where, B, plea was not entered or ratified by defendant or person authorized to act in defendant's behalf.
Sure, and again, I would just say everything we've talked about before is the way that would happen here. I also, in conjunction, would like to call the court's attention to a case I cited at pages 10 and 11 in my brief, a case called Dunkel. And Dunkel is a good vehicle to identify that the way the defendant's plea of no contest or guilty is conveyed to the court can be through the attorney. Now, I'm saying that's not closure to it. It still needs to be personally ratified through this colloquy and the Bangert requirements. But if I may just read the quote from Dunkel. Quote, "It is no legal fiction to assume that an accused person, represented by an attorney, a member of the bar, who after consultation with and in the presence of the accused, announces to the court a desire to change a plea from not guilty to guilty, is himself pleading that it is his plea of guilty, that is the defendant's plea of guilty, and should have the same force and effect as if he himself had spoken the words." Now again, I'm saying the means of conveying this can be done that way, but the defendant still has to personally ratify it through this colloquy.
That's right. So there has to be some, the bench book goes through the procedure, as does the special materials. The special materials indicates the court should inquire personally of the defendant, how do you plead? The bench book indicates that what the court does is ask the prosecutor to state the plea agreement, then both the defense and attorney must affirm the correctness of the plea agreement, that then the defendant enters a plea of guilty or no contest, so it sets out the procedure. What more can this court do than say, we've got special materials that's, 14 pages long. Number one, the first thing we tell you is inquire personally of the defendant. How do you plead? We have a bench book. That excerpt on procedure for taking a plea is about the same length of pages. And on the very first page, it says, defendant enters a plea after you ask the prosecutor to state the plea agreement. And both the attorney and the defendant affirm the correctness of the plea agreement. We set it out. We say do it right.
Of course, what I'm saying here is that it wasn't done wrong, because when the defendant presented this written questionnaire that says, I wish to plead no contest, it would have been redundant at that point for the court. I mean, it would have been prudent. Don't get me wrong. It would have been prudent. But you can see how the court, given that circumstance, can miss that because it would be redundant. He knows what the defendant is doing.
As a trial judge, I never, and I perhaps should have, but I never once, to my recollection, asked the defendant, when did you fill out this plea questionnaire? Now, sometimes I'd see them scurrying right in front of me and filling it out, so it was obvious, but I never once asked them. It seems to me that a statement a week ago that I wish to enter a plea may not fulfill the instructions that we've already given, and that concerns me. What to do about that concern?
Of course, in this particular case, the trial court did find out when he did it, and it was contemporaneously. It was that morning. But I think the answer
contemporaneous in the day.
In the same day. I mean, yeah. And I don't know the exact time, but that the subsequent plea colloquy, that the conformance with 97108, the Bangert requirements, I mean, I'm suggesting, or if this court wants to add, how do you plead as part of those requirements, short of that, but I don't think that even if that's missed, even if this court were to conclude in this case that somehow that was, that wasn't accomplished through the written plea questionnaire, the defendant is entitled to a windfall any more than he would be if his plea was not, if the colloquy itself didn't reflect knowing involuntariness. We still look at the totality of the circumstances under Bangert, and that's what I would suggest applies here. If there are no more questions.
Oh, I have another question. And Justice Prosser has a question.
Would your position be any different if at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Johnson had stood up and said, the defendant wishes to simply withdraw any inference that he entered a plea?
In that situation, I would characterize it as a pre-sentence plea withdrawal request. That, in other words, it would not have affected the validity of the plea in the first instance. That The fact that he has not said anything is sort of secondary support, if you will, or after-the-fact support that he knew what he was doing, what he intended. If at the time of sentencing he now says, I don't want to be stuck with this plea anymore, I want a trial, I'm saying that that should be treated just like a pre-sentence plea withdrawal request should be. It shouldn't affect the validity of the plea itself. In other words, that the plea had, in fact, been entered.
Should we attach any significance to the fact that he did participate in a pre-sentence investigation and went through a sentencing hearing and didn't say anything?
That would be the second part of Bangert. In other words, if this court were to conclude that the plea colloquy itself and everything that happened there wasn't good enough, and you go to the second step, in order to establish what the defendant understood about, or to establish that it was the defendant's personal decision, and that's where that would come in under that second step. Thank you.
Counsel, one of, I think, your opposing counsel's stronger arguments is on the Farr case. In the Farr case, of course, we said we can't infer that what the defendant did here. We need the defendant by a direct and specific admission about, this came in the context of penalty enhancer, and he says in his brief on page 16, he argues, if admitting to one's status as a repeater for sentencing purposes can only be accomplished by a direct and specific admission from the defendant himself, then surely nothing less can be acceptable when the plea itself is at issue. Could you respond?
Sure. I think the state's position is perfectly consistent with Farr in this way. Language in Farr has to be understood in the context in which the case arose. That is, at the time of sentencing, neither when the prosecutor said that the defendant told the sentencing court the defendant is subject to repeater enhancement, neither the defendant nor his attorney said anything. This court then said that an attorney could not make the repeater admission for the defendant, and then used this language, quote, must be a direct and specific admission by the defendant. If the defendant remains mute and the attorney says something, that wouldn't be good enough. But this language doesn't mean that, for example, if the attorney says, my client wishes to enter a repeater admission, and then that repeater admission is presented in writing, signed by the defendant, that would be a way of being a direct and specific admission by the defendant.
Are you suggesting that we can use the plea questionnaire as a written entry of a plea?
In conjunction with the confirmance at the plea colloquy that it was his personal decision. It's confirming what was said.
But doesn't personal decision go to whether or not it was freely, voluntarily, intelligently made? I mean, that conceptually there's a difference between whether or not it was freely, voluntarily, and intelligently made and whether it was made at all. It seems to me the argument about personal decision really goes to the voluntariness and freeness of the decision of the plea as opposed to whether it was made.
That's what that question, how do you plead, gets to, though, is that it is, in fact, the defendant's personal decision. Nobody's speaking for him. And again, on this record, I would submit that that was conveyed to the court personally by the defendant, and an adequate record was made.
Must the defendant be present at all pleas of a criminal nature?
At misdemeanors, there is not a requirement of the defendant's presence. That can be, he does not have to be present at a guilty or no contest plea to a misdemeanor, as I understand the law. But there's still a requirement that it be established, the constitutional requirement of voluntariness still must be established.
So
it doesn't have to be personal.
Does not have to be there personally, right?
So in that case, can an attorney enter a plea?
That's my understanding, correct.
What is the source of that information?
Case law, Baker, and I'm blanking out on the other case. Baker is one of them. Prowse, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freiman. Mr. Cushing, you have about 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'll start right where we left off. Those misdemeanor cases pay lip service to this principle that somehow you can enter a plea without being present. But in both cases, the defendant was allowed to withdraw his plea because the record was held to be inadequate by the Court of Appeals in I'm going to get these right. Krauss is a court of appeals case. Baker is this court's case. In both cases, the sentence appears in the decisions that in a misdemeanor, a defendant may plead guilty without appearing. But in both cases, the plea was withdrawn because the record was inadequate. So I don't know how much utility it is to say it can be done, but we haven't seen a situation yet where an appellate court approved of a plea taken under those circumstances. And I don't know, I certainly don't want to repeat myself here. The record is obviously clear. The court is familiar with it. I am familiar with it. The issue, as I see it, is fairly straightforward and simple. And my position has always been fairly simple. And that is that this gentleman, Mr. Burns, did not plead no contest to this charge, and therefore he can't be sentenced. And if this court is going to infer his plea from this record, that's certainly within the court's authority. The problem is that that will not solve the problem for the next record that contains this type of an issue. And that's
so I understand that, counsel, when you say he did not plead, in the written questionnaire, it said, I plead no contest.
No.
What did it say?
It said, I wish to enter a plea, and it had a little box checked on the check mark.
Okay.
That's
no contest.
No contest, correct.
And then we had the oral colloquy.
Correct. Yes. The record speaks for itself. I can't change the record.
Right.
I can only say that the court should adopt some procedures that don't require us to litigate this issue over and over again in every case where this problem occurs. And I do not believe that this should be lumped in with the Bangert-type procedures. You're going to create a situation involving cumbersome evidentiary hearings for trial judges to decide whether a defendant did or did not plead no contest. This issue, I think, can be resolved by resort to this record. If the state says, well, you use Bangert, but then the state's argument is, well, but you don't have to use Bangert because you can infer that he entered his plea from the record.
Well, one of the issues in Bangert was that it would create a lot of more hearings. Has it?
Yes, I believe it has, and it has created sometimes the hearings get short-circuited, but it has certainly created a lot of more work to try to determine whether hearings are necessary or not, discussions with clients about what they did or didn't know, and their lawyers and their family to shore up, to find out whether you can make the prima facie case that Bangert requires you to make, because you have to allege that not only was the plea colloquy invalid, but your client really didn't know something. And the situation here, I think, is different because the issue here isn't whether your client knew something or didn't know something, or it's whether he did what the law requires at the hearing of which we have a transcript. So I would urge the court to try to reach a resolution which resolves these type of issues based on the record. If the state is correct, then the court can just infer that there was a valid plea. Although they say we should use Bangert, they're not suggesting this case should be remanded for some type of hearing. Because according to their argument, he did plead guilty or no contest. And if that were true, then you don't need Bangert to decide that. And I would urge the court to adopt the clear rule consistent with Farr. And Justice Bradley's question is, you know, what more can we do other than paying lip service and keep saying it's the better practice? Well, what you can do is vacate a conviction or two when the courts don't do it correct, and they will begin to do it correctly. And I don't view it as a windfall to my client. The record here was inadequate, in my opinion. No valid plea was entered. I urge the court to hold that and to create a rule which is enforced. And perhaps a couple of convictions will have to be reversed. But once the rule is enforced and this court and the Court of Appeals enforces it, most of the litigation will stop, in my opinion. Thank you.
Mr. Cushing, you know, we have three cases this morning that involve these similar themes. And as I was going through them, I tried to look at this, this plea form. Is that a form that's put out by the court records?
There is one in the special materials. I don't know if the one used in this case was. I can tell you that I see and this is something I did want to mention, these forms are used, and some counties use them, most counties have some version of this form. They're all different. Some contain only the most basic information, which almost all of them have the constitutional rights that you're waiving. But whether it has the maximum on it, whether it has the elements of the crime, whether it says I wish to plead or something about the plea, that is different in every county that uses the form. I mean, some use similar forms, but there are a variety of versions of that form in use.
Justice Prosser.
If your rule is adopted, how would you handle situations where a defendant literally was unable to speak?
Well, I believe the court that the defendant could write out a plea, let's say, in court. My rule is oral, but yes, if a defendant couldn't speak because he was mute, the translator, sign language could be used that came directly from the defendant. I believe if the defendant were to sign a document in court, in the presence of the court, that would certainly suffice to convince me that the defendant himself had entered a valid plea. There are other ways, and I guess an interpreter writing, but I would want it done in court at the plea proceeding and not some document which had been filled out a month earlier or under circumstances that aren't apparent in the record. Thank you.
The court will take a few moments of recess, thank you, counsel, in order to allow the camera to be taken down and out. Thank you.